After about 5 or 6 minutes, one of the aircraft from the circling formation left its place in the formation and lowered itself down right next to the stationary aircraft. In fact, it appeared to touch it and stayed stationary next to the center aircraft as if it were giving some kind of assistance for about 3 or 4 minutes. It was then we heard a dull thud, like an underground explosion or a thud similar to a man stamping his heel on damp ground. Immediately following this sound, the center aircraft began spewing forth what seemed like thousands of newspapers from somewhere on the inside of its center. These newspapers, which turned out to be a white type of very lightweight metal, fluttered to earth, most of them lighting in the bay. It then seemed to hail on us, in the bay and over the beach, black or darker type metal which looked similar to lava rock. We did not know if this metal was coming from the aircraft but assumed that it was, as it fell at the same time that the white type metal was falling. However, since these fragments were of a darker color, we did not observe them until they started hitting the beach and the bay. All of these latter fragments seemed hot, almost molten. When they hit the bay, steam rose from the water. We ran for the shelter under a cliff on the beach and behind logs to protect ourselves from the falling debris. In spite of our precaution, my son's arm was injured by one of the falling fragments and our dog was hit and killed. We buried the dog at sea on our return trip to Tacoma. After this rain of metal seemed over, all of these strange aircraft lifted slowly and drifted out to the westward, which is out to sea. They rose and disappeared at a tremendous height. The center aircraft, which had spewed the debris, did not seem to be hindered in its flight and still remained in the center of the formation as they all rose and disappeared out to sea. We tried to pick up several pieces of the metal or fragments and found them very hot. In fact, I almost burned my fingers, but after some of them had cooled, we loaded a considerable number of the pieces aboard the boat. We also picked up some of the metal which had looked like falling newspapers. My crew and I discussed this observance for a while and I attempted to radio from my patrol boat back to my base. The static was so great it was impossible for me to reach my radio station. This I attributed to the presence of these aircraft, as my radio had been in perfect operating order and the weather would not have caused this amount of interference. The wheelhouse on our boat had been hit by the falling debris and damaged. We immediately started our engines and went directly to Tacoma, where my boy was given first aid at the hospital there. Upon reaching the dock, I had to tell my superior officer how the boar had been damaged and why the dog had not returned with us. I related our experience to Fred L. Crisman, my superior officer. I could plainly see that he did not believe it, and I guess I don't blame him, but we gave him the camera with its film and the fragments of metal we had loaded aboard as proof of our story. Fred L. Crisman decided he would at least go and investigate the beach where I judged at least 20 tons of the debris had fallen. I might add that these strange aircraft appeared completely round, but seemed a little squashed on the top and on the bottom as if you placed a large board on an inner tube and squashed it slightly. The film from our camera, developed, showed these strange aircraft, but the negatives were covered with spots similar to a negative that has been close to an X-ray room before it has been exposed, except that the spots prints white instead of black as in the usual case. This was the story that Harold A. Dahl related to me the evening of July 29, 1947 in room 502 in the Winthrop Hotel in Tacoma, Washington. Harold had moved from the chair to the bed and sat rather stooped over, wringing his hands as if terribly worried about something. I asked him what he was worried about and he said that he only hoped that in relating his experience he wouldn't have any more bad luck or that he would wish any on me. He seemed to hesitate, then he started talking again. Harold Dahl went on to tell me that early the very next morning after he had his experience, a gentleman called at his home and invited him to breakfast. I was about 7 o'clock. According to Dahl, this wasn't particularly unusual. He said that many lumber buyers did call on people in his type of work with the purpose of buying salvaged logs and that they frequently called on him very early in the morning. This gentleman, Dahl continued, wore a black suit, was of medium height, and there was nothing unusual about his appearance. however. He seemed more the type of man who would be an insurance salesman or who followed a less strenuous type of work than logging. He appeared to be about 40 years of age. Dahl accepted his invitation and they walked out to the curb. Dahl noticed that he drove a 1947 Buick sedan. Since Dahl had to go downtown anyway, this average-looking gentleman suggested that Dahl drive his own car and follow him. While driving downtown, Harold was unable to get the license number of the cart he was following. He made no special point to do so. He felt sure the fellow wanted to buy some salvaged logs or equipment from him. It happens almost every morning in harbor patrol work. It did seem rather funny, as Harold put it, that this gentleman was taking Harold to breakfast in the uptown section of Tacoma rather than in the lower dock section, which is the usual place where loggers and salvage operators congregate. Finally, he stopped in front of a little nook cafe and motioned for Harold to follow him. By this time, Dahl's curiosity was aroused, almost to the point of asking him right on the curb what he wanted. They went inside and ordered their breakfast. The minute this man sat down in the booth, he began relating in great detail the experience that Harold and his crew had had the day before. He did this with such accuracy, Harold said, it was shocking. This man talked as if he had been on the boat with them the entire trip. Harold knew he had never seen the man before. He was completely baffled at what he was hearing. After the man finished, he made the remark, "What I have said is proof to you that I know a great deal more about this experience of yours than you will to believe." He made the flat statements that Harold and his crew had made an observation that shouldn't have happened for some mysterious reason, and he was giving him some sound advice. This man told Harold that if he loved his family and didn't want anything to happen to his general welfare, he would not discuss his experience with anyone. Harold told me, "I don't put much stock in what this fellow said. He sounded like some kind of a crackpot to me. I didn't think it was amazing how he knew what we had seen. Why a total stranger would make such an issue of something no one could help did have me rather puzzled. I didn't have any intention of keeping my experience a secret when I went back to the docks that morning. I discussed my experience openly and truthfully with many other seamen at the pier that morning. I asked for Fred Crisman, my superior officer, and found out he had taken one of the boats out alone. The last anyone knew of him that morning was that he had headed towards Maury Island. That afternoon, Fred L. Crisman returned with the boat and, according to Dahl, he didn't have much to say. He did stop criticizing Dahl for seeing things, and he started making arrangements for the repair of the boat that Harold had been operating. I sat there on the edge of the bed looking at Dahl. I was thinking that before I came to Tacoma, I was sure I had heard everything. Dahl's story was the wildest thing I had ever listened to, and still, as far as I could tell, he was deadly earnest about every bit of it. There was quite a long silence. It must have been about 5 minutes. I, frankly, couldn't think of anything to say. Finally, Harold Dahl got up from where he had been sitting on the edge of the bed. He suggested that he take me out to his secretary's house, where he had quite a few of the fragments he had brought back from Maury Island, that is, if I would care to see them. I did. By this time, I had completely forgotten about maybe saving any of my $200 expense money. We left the hotel and drove in Harold's car out to his secretary's home. It was a rather unpretentious looking little house, standing all alone on a corner. The evening was bright and clear, and it took us 10 minutes to get there. I noticed particularly the streets and the avenue we took. I thought to myself, I may go out there in the morning and look it over in the daylight. This was the first time I had ever played investigator, and I guess I thought investigators would make notes of that kind. I know now I would have been better off to let Perry Mason do the job. I couldn't believe Harold Dahl's story, even though I could see absolutely no reason to doubt his sincerity and could find nothing that he could gain from telling a lie. We pulled up in front of a house, got out and walked up a rather cracked sidewalk to a wooden porch. The porch had no screens and there were no rugs on the floor. I remember the white spindle-like porch supports. Harold knocked on the side of the doorway and then opened the screen door. It was hinged on the west and opened on the east. There was enough light from the street light so that I could see the house was of about a 1912 vintage and could have used another coat of white paint. I turned the doorknob of the main door. It was hinged on the east and opened inward from the west. The door was of a dark wood like mahogany. Although not hand-carved, it gave a hand-carved effect. The doorknob was oblong with little raised grapes or insignia on it. The window in the front door was the etched picture kind of glass. Upon entering the house, I saw a piano to my left against the wall. A bedroom led directly off to the right of the front room. The entire front room was very narrow with a slight archway between the farther end of the front room and a small open dining room. Another archway tunneled into the kitchen in the rear. Next to the piano by the west window was a large radio, about a 1937 model, with its wires trailing through the edge of the window paneled to the outside. I could see from the reflected light of the room the aerial going up outside the house. The base of the aerial was made of 2 2x2s. There was a piano bench at the piano. On top of the piano were several Cupid dolls such as you win at sideshows, trimmed with ostrich feathers, and some inexpensive plaster of Paris animal figurines. Harold went directly through the front room and dining room into the kitchen. A woman about 40 years of age, Harold's secretary, was in the kitchen. She was deeply engrossed in writing checks and doing bookwork. Papers, receipts, and notes were laid every available place in the kitchen. I was following close behind Harold. I thought he was leading me to the fragments he had spoken of. He introduced me to his secretary. I can't recall her name. I had been told she was a widow and had several children and that this was her home. I gathered that her bookwork was generally done down at some office at the docks, but that she had brought the books and the checkbook home to catch up on her work since it was nearing the end of July. Harold turned from his secretary and asked me to return to the front room and help myself to a chair. Within a few seconds he followed, sat on the edge of the piano bench and handed me a dark-colored rock ashtray. He said, "Here is one of the fragments from Maury Island, we've been using it as an ashtray." I remember saying, "Why, Harold, that's only a piece of lava rock." Harold said, "Well, I don't know much about metals, but this is some of the stuff that hit our boat and there must be about 20 tons more of it over on the shores of Maury Island. I don't have any of the white metal here but Fred Crisman has a whole box full in his garage. We go over there right away if you'd like to see that, too." "Oh, that isn't too important," I said. "Not tonight, I'll have a look at it tomorrow." If I had only read some of the clippings I had stuffed into my coat pocket before I left Boise, this lava rock would really have rung a bell in my mind. Since June 24th I had been collecting clippings and listening to stories so hot and heavy that I had little chance to digest some of the things I should have known. The rest of the evening we spent talking about hunting and fishing. Harold drove me back to my hotel a little after midnight. Just before parting with Dahl that evening in front of the hotel I asked if he would have Mr. Crisman come to see me in the morning. I was really tired that night and went to bed completely forgetting that I had had no supper. I would probably have slept until noon the next day if I hadn't been awakened by a banging on my door. It was about 9:30 in the morning. Both Crisman and Dahl had come to see me. Fred Crisman was a short stocky fellow, dark complexioned, a happy-go-lucky appearing person, very cheerful and extremely alert. He was practically bubbling over to tell me his story. Up until this time I hadn't heard about his experience. Crisman began telling me how furious he was with Harold Dahl when he returned to the docks with his wild tale and the damaged boat. He said he had cussed Harold out for damaging the boat. Harold broke in, saying, "Yeah, Crisman thought we'd all been drunk." Fred Crisman piped up with, "I certainly did think they had gotten drunk. The only thing I couldn't figure out was how poor navigation could account for all the damage to the boat, all of it done on the wheelhouse and the upper deck. It looked like they had taken a sledgehammer and tried to sink it from the top down. Chrisman was evidently talking from experience. I guess that in times before when liquor was aboard one of his boats it was always the bottom of the craft that had been damaged from crashing into rocks or whatever men do with a boat when they are drunk. My curiosity rose, Fred Chrisman continued, when I considered the peculiar way the boat had been damaged. I sneaked off the next morning early to go over to Maury Island to see if there actually was 20 tons of this debris on the beach like Dahl said. On arriving at Maury Island I did find all the debris, lava rock and some of the white metal that Harold had told me about. Now, Fred said, to make the story worse, while I stood looking at these fragments, holding a few pieces in my hand. One of the same kind of aircraft that Harold described to me came right out of a large far cumulus cloud and made a wide circle of this little bay. The aircraft was banked at about a 10-degree angle. It had no visible means of propulsion. It was more like a large inner tube with round eyes or portholes around it on the outside. It made no noise, and circled the bay as if it was looking for something. It did not seem slightly squished as Harold described the sixth the day before. I hold a commercial pilot's license. I flew over 100 missions in fighter aircraft over Burma in the last war and I feel qualified to describe it accurately. Harold doesn't know how to fly. I would say the portholes around this strange airplane were about 5 feet in diameter. Also, I would say it had a definite observation window and the whole surface appeared to be metal, burled and of a brassy color, almost golden. As the sun hit it, it showed more brilliance than a solid polished surface would show. I had the feeling as Chrisman talked that, solid as appeared, he definitely wanted to domineer the conversation and trends of thought about the entire Maury Island incident. Harold Dahl seemed more in favor of taking little or no part in further discussion of the subject. Dahl in no way attempted to sell his story to me or to review it any further. He didn't try to convince me of the truth of what he had already told me. This was July 30, 1947 and by now it was about 11 o'clock in the morning. I had gotten dressed during the discussion and ordered breakfast to be sent up to all three of us. While eating breakfast I reached in my coat pocket and took out a number of newspaper clippings and offs and ends I had hurriedly put in my pocket in Boise. Oddly enough, the top clipping of the handful, which I had barely glanced at before, mentioned cinder or lava ash particles that had fallen from the sky near Mountain Home, Idaho the 12th day of July after a formation of flying saucers had passed over that area. The man who picked up portions of this ash sent it to the state chemical laboratory for analysis. Right then and there I became inwardly excited about the fragments I had seen the night before. I wanted some immediately and even though our meetings had been entirely in the talking stage I put a great deal more credence in Dahl's and Chrisman's stories of their experiences. I seemed all of a sudden to wake up and wanted to get to doing things. I told Dahl I would like to see the photographs he had taken, even if they were bad, and asked Chrisman for some of the white metal as well as other fragments he had stored in his garage. Then I really got an idea, Smithy. I asked Chrisman and Dahl if they would mind if I asked Captain E.J. Smith of United Airlines to come down and help us try to get to the bottom of this thing. I explained to them that Big Smithy had become involved in this thing innocently, too. I was sure he would be as anxious to obtain some physical evidence of flying saucers as I was. Somehow at the point I completely forgot about Mr. Raymond Palmer back in Evanston, Illinois. Suddenly I was finding out things for myself, not for Mr. Palmer. Dahl and Chrisman said they didn't care if I asked Big Smithy over. I got busy on the telephone right then and called United Airlines, Flight Operations, at Boeing Field in Seattle. They gave me Captain Smith's phone number and luckily I was able to reach him. I told Captain Smith what I had bumped into in Tacoma and asked him if he would like to come over. He told me he had the afternoon off and would like to join in the investigation. I said I'd fly up to Seattle right away, meet him in front of the terminal building, and fly him back to Tacoma. Not only did I like Captain Smith's company, but felt he was much more qualified to determine the authenticity of Dahl's and Chrisman's stories than I was. Dahl had some odds and ends to take care of down at the dock, so Fred Chrisman drove me to Barry's Airport in his Ford Roadster. I climbed in my plane and took off for Seattle. By the time I got there, Smithy was waiting for me. I didn't know exactly what to believe. Big Smithy seemed to be enthusiastic about the whole thing. After paying our check at the newsstand, we went out, climbed in my plane and took off for Tacoma. I bet Big Smithy will never forget that flight. He'd been flying DC-6s from Seattle to Chicago, and what a come down it was to the funny-looking little one-engine plane I own. About the only thing on my ship that is metal is the engine. I'll never forget Captain Smith chuckling at my airspeed only registering 105 miles per hour. After a number of assurances on my part that my plane was really safe, he settled down to enjoy the ride. Chapter 3. The Mysterious Informant. We arrived in Tacoma about 3 o'clock and parked my airplane at Barry's Airport. Fred Chrisman was waiting and drove us up to my hotel. He let us out, saying he would go down, pick up Dahl, and be back in about an hour. I told Captain Smith as we were walking into the hotel that I, for one, didn't want any newspaper reporters around or any publicity about what we were doing. I asked him not to tell United Airlines what he was doing in Tacoma with me. There were a number of things about the stories of Chrisman and Dahl that didn't quite ring true, but at that time, it was beyond me to evaluate what I had heard and seen. We went directly to my room. I phoned an order for coffee and rolls and then brought Captain Smith up to date on everything that had happened. A little over an hour and a half later, Chrisman and Dahl arrived. Dahl and Chrisman told Captain Smith their stories separately. I showed him the news clipping about the discs and lava ash and told him that neither Chrisman or Dahl had seen the clipping or knew anything about it. I recall Captain Smith taking off his suit coat, throwing it on the back of a chair, and saying to me, "Ken, whether you like it or not, you've got a roommate. I'm going to stay here until I find out what gives." I was tickled to death. I thought, "Boy, now we're going to get to the bottom of things." We were engrossed with our coffee and rolls for about 15 minutes. No one said too much, but I know everybody was doing a lot of thinking. Captain Smith finally broke the silence, thereby starting a cross-examination which covered every possible phase of everybody's relationship and experiences up to the present date. It took an hour and a half, and I don't think J. Edgar Hoover could have done a better job. When Smithy got through, we weren't any farther ahead than we were when we started. Somehow Chrisman's and Dahl's stories couldn't be broken down. After this, Smithy was more convinced than ever that he wanted to stay a few days with me to see how everything came out. He asked Chrisman to drive him up to Seattle so he could get his automobile and a toothbrush. He phoned United Airlines and cancelled his flights for the next day on the excuse that he was visiting a friend. I know he didn't tell United Airlines what he was doing. He and Chrisman left, saying they'd be back within a couple of hours. Harold Dahl made the excuse that his wife wasn't feeling well and that he had to go home to supper. He said he would come back later on in the evening. I locked the room and went out for a cup of coffee. I was gone about an hour. I'll never forget the feeling I had in the pit of my stomach. Somehow it seemed like we weren't getting any place, and I kind of wished I was back home. It must have been about 7:30 or 8 o'clock when Captain Smith returned. He hadn't had any supper and he suggested we drive someplace. His car was a light green deluxe model Town & Country Chrysler. I told Smithy that no one but plutocrats could afford buggies like that. We drove out to the edge of Tacoma, talking about the events of the day. We had dinner in a rather secluded cafe that I think Captain Smith knew about, for it was strange to me. We got back to the hotel just a little before Chrisman and Dahl arrived. I sort of relaxed and let Captain Smith take over, as he seemed to have a good system. I remember that before Dahl and Chrisman left, Smith asked to see a bunch of the fragments, both the white and the lava rock kind. He also wanted to see the pictures, and he wanted to go to Maury Island to see the debris that had been so talked about and that was supposed to be there on the beach. Dahl and Chrisman agreed to everything he asked. They invited us to have breakfast with them the next morning at a little loggers' cafe where we would have the opportunity to meet their harbor patrol crews. We accepted their invitation and they left. It was about 10 o'clock. Smithy and I thought that now we were getting someplace. We were both pretty tired. Smithy walked over and flopped on my bed. In doing so, he knocked the pillow off my bed, revealing that I had a .32 automatic pistol. He became very interested in it and asked me if I was worried about something. I remember feeling rather sheepish about it. I said that I honestly didn't know why I had brought it along, that I rarely carried it with me. I explained to Smithy that it had been a present from Colonel Paul Wieland of Provo, Utah. Smithy sure liked that pistol and asked me if I would sell it, as it was just the size he would like to carry with him when he flew. The conversation drifted from Colonel Paul to Red Tides to the crashed C-46 Marine transport, which had finally been found that month on the southwest side of Mount Rainier. We did a great deal of laughing and joking about the crazy things people were saying about flying saucers. We were, in fact, laughing and joking just a little bit artificially. We both had a peculiar feeling that we were being watched, or that there was something dangerous about getting involved with Chrisman and Dahl. First was our suspicion of a hoax. Second was our suspicion that Russian espionage was baiting us on the whole affair for a very simple season: to find out if actually we knew that these flying saucers were made in the United States and were a military secret. We reasoned this way: that our relationship with Russia was not on too friendly a basis, and we both knew we had given reports that were accurate and correct as far as we had observed these strange craft. It was publicly known that we had been interrogated by military intelligence. Russian agents might assume that we had been secretly assured that these craft were of our own manufacture. By watching us or getting us involved in something of this kind, we might privately confide in each other what, supposedly, the military had secretly assured us. Thus a foreign government would have an assured knowledge of what these things were and where they came from in case they were being sighted over their own country. At this time we didn't even dream of the possibility that they could come from another world. Although Smithy and I did not talk much about it that evening, we both felt safe, or with a gun in our possession. We had just settled down to go to sleep when the phone rang. It was Ted Morlow of United Press. I later found out he was UP's head man in Tacoma, with offices in the Tacoma Times building. I immediately started to hang up on him when he said, "Hold on a minute. Some crackpot has been phoning us here, telling us verbatim what has been going on in your hotel room for the last day." I told him we would not admit or deny anything. Morlow proceeded to tell me, step by step, what we had been doing. I was amazed at the accuracy of what he told me, but I didn't let on to Morlow that it was true. We had both been bothered several times by a reporter from the Tacoma Times named Paul Lance earlier in the day. He had met us in the lobby and tried to strike up a conversation with us, and he came up to our room several times that afternoon attempting to get a story. We had questioned Paul Lance as to how he knew we were there and his suspicion that it had something to do with flying saucers. We had absolutely refused to talk to any reporters, and Paul Lance was no exception. Both Smith and I suspected Dahl or Chrisman of leaking out the information as to what was going on in our room. Ted Morlow of United Press not only told me, but I turned the phone over to Captain Smith. He was equally amazed at what Morlow knew, particularly when he quoted things that had been said in the room that evening when neither Dahl or Chrisman were present. We thanked Morlow for his kindness, told him he was all wet, which was not true, and as Smithy set the phone back on the stand, we both began to worry. We were sure someone had a dictaphone planted in our room. We spent the next hour tearing that room apart, from the mattresses to the transoms. It was a corner room and we had a definite advantage. We were 5 stories up on 2 sides and with heavy panels between us and the hallway and the adjoining room on the west and the south. We could not find any wires or any microphone behind, underneath, or on anything in that room. I didn't dare say how I felt, but Smithy was visibly concerned and disturbed. For the next half hour, before we finally went to sleep, we carried on our conversation in whispers. The next morning, July 31st, Captain Smith and I were awakened by Chrisman and Dahl. Their arms were loaded with heavy lava rock fragments, and Chrisman has a number of pieces of the white metal that he said came from